case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Crane against Kentucky.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. In this case, the Kentucky Supreme Court drew an artificial distinction between evidence of the confession's voluntariness and evidence of its credibility. That distinction is premised on a fundamental misunderstanding of a confession's constitutional voluntariness and its factual reliability, and it resulted in a violation of the petitioner's right of cross-examination and his right to present a defense. Reduced to its simplest form, the issue in this case is whether a defendant can be constitutionally prohibited from introducing evidence about the circumstances under which his confession was obtained for the purpose of showing its or challenging its credibility simply because the trial judge has determined the confession to be voluntary and therefore admissible. At the outset, defense counsel in this case indicated in her opening statement that her theory of defense was the circumstances under which this confession was obtained were so demonstrated the confession's lack of credibility and that lack of credibility created doubt as to the petitioner's guilt. The prosecution, in turn, perceiving defense counsel's challenge as an attack on the trial court's determination of the confession's constitutional voluntariness, moved that defense be prohibited from introducing any evidence about the circumstances under which the confession was obtained. The trial judge then ruled that the defense could show evidence about the factual inaccuracies and mistakes contained within the body of the confession, but would be precluded from introducing any evidence about the circumstances relating to the confession's voluntariness. Consequently, the defense was prohibited from introducing any evidence about the size of the interrogation room, the number of police officers that conducted the interrogation.
And what issue would that have borne on, Mr. Hatt?
That bears on the credibility of the confession, Your Honor. The length of the interrogation and detention, the number of police officers present, and the size of the room.
Now, you say that even though it were determined that the confession was voluntarily given, those factors would perhaps induce the jury to believe what?
That the confession also lacks credibility. That evidence
Why?
Well, the evidence obviously is germane to voluntariness. It's also germane to credibility because here, the petitioner's statement or confession is just riddled with factual mistakes and inaccuracies.
Well, but didn't the trial court say you could produce evidence as to inaccuracies?
Yes, and indeed, defense counsel did introduce that evidence. He introduced evidence about the misstatement of the gun, the fact that the petitioner said an alarm sounded, there was no alarm, the fact that the petitioner said he stole money.
But the simply mistakes in the confession.
But there's a reason for those mistakes, Your Honor, and the jury was precluded from hearing any evidence as to why the petitioner made those statements. And the facts surrounding the procurement of the confession are germane to a determination of why the petitioner made those statements. The petitioner here was interrogated for a period of time of approximately an hour and 40 minutes. And indeed, the jury was not informed of the fact that the petitioner was questioned and talked about this particular liquor store robbery for some nearly 45 minutes before he gave the written waiver of his constitutional rights and before the statement was actually taped. Now, surely those circumstances are germane to the issue of credibility because what happened in that interrogation room does have a bearing on why the petitioner.
You wanted to get in, you couldn't get in, was the size of the room and the number of officers in it.
That's true. Those we wanted to get those.
Those
facts
are the only two facts that you wanted to get before the jury that you didn't want to, that you didn't get before the jury.
Well, when the confession
is that true or not?
Yes, that's correct. And the length of time of the interrogation.
Yes. Well, but you say even if those are the only facts, they were still very relevant to reliability.
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
The Kentucky Supreme Court in ruling.
Now, Mr. Heff, do you suppose that even if there was an error here, that it could be harmless and that harmless error analysis would be appropriate to apply?
No, Your Honor, we don't feel that this error is harmless. We believe that this error is such as to create doubt about the outcome of the trial and to raise doubt about the reliability of the jury's verdict.
Well, do you agree that it is subject to harmless error analysis?
Well, I think that based on the Court's most recent pronouncement, I'm referring to Delaware Van Arsdale, the fact that a restriction on the defendant's right of cross-examination, that's certainly a subject to the harmless error analysis. The Kentucky Supreme Court, in ruling on this issue, relied on this Court's decisions in Jackson v. Deno and Lego v. Toomey and concluded that the petitioner or the defense could introduce evidence about the credibility, the reliability, and the weight of the confession, but the defense was precluded from introducing any evidence about the circumstances under which the confession was obtained. And we would submit that that's based on an artificial distinction that the Court sought to draw on evidence of credibility and evidence of voluntariness. Evidence about the circumstances under which the confession was obtained necessarily overlaps with the issue of voluntariness and the issue of credibility. Moreover, the Kentucky Court ruled that the trial court's findings on the issue of the constitutional voluntariness of this confession were conclusive, and were conclusive to the extent of preventing the defendant from introducing any evidence about the circumstances under which the confession was given, simply because the trial judge had relied on those facts in determining the confession's constitutional voluntariness.
You don't insist that the issue of constitutional voluntariness has to be submitted to the jury, do you?
No, Your Honor. The Kentucky Supreme Court's decision reflects a fundamental misunderstanding about the effect of the trial judge's ruling or his determination that the confession is constitutionally voluntary. And it further fails to recognize the very different purposes served by suppression hearings and trial. In a suppression hearing, of course, the judge's function is to determine the evidence about the circumstances under which the confession was obtained and determine whether or not the confession is constitutionally voluntary based upon prevailing constitutional standards. The trial judge doesn't determine the confession's truth, its falsity, its credibility, or its reliability. The jury, on the other hand, is charged during the course of the trial, is charged with precisely that responsibility. It has to determine the confession's truth, its falsity, its credibility, and its weight in order to make its ultimate determination on the issue of guilt or innocence. The jury simply cannot fulfill that function, whereas here they're precluded from hearing evidence about the circumstances under which the confession was obtained. The Kentucky Supreme Court's ruling violates the petitioner's right to present a defense and his right to cross-examination because here defense counsel is prevented from introducing evidence that supports his theory of the defense that the confession is so lacking in credibility that it doesn't have to be believed by the jury and that the jury doesn't have to give it any weight. I think it's probably easy to summarize this by saying that although the jury could hear about the factual inaccuracies of the confession, the jury simply doesn't understand or is not giving any evidence to determine why the petitioner made those statements. Why did he misstate such pertinent facts about the circumstances surrounding this crime?
Your client didn't offer to testify. He didn't take the stand, did he?
He didn't testify at trial, Your Honor.
Yeah, so it's not a question of his having been prevented from testifying about something that he wanted to testify to.
No, this is not a Fifth Amendment situation, Your Honor. It's the right to cross-examination. Consequently, we would submit that the effect of the Kentucky court's ruling is to deny the petitioner an opportunity to answer and defend against the state's charge. The petitioner has been prevented from introducing evidence about the circumstances under which his confession was obtained, and the jury cannot therefore make a reliable assessment of the confession's credibility and its weight, because the jury cannot examine the effect of those circumstances under which his confession was obtained for determining its credibility and its weight. Ostensibly, the state interest that was sought to be protected in this situation was to prevent relitigation of the issue of the confession's constitutional voluntariness. But that issue simply can't be advanced or protected by a blanket rule that prevents the defendant from introducing circumstances under which his confession is given, especially where the rule is here is premised on such an artificial distinction between the confession's voluntariness and evidence of its credibility. The effect of such a rule is to undermine confidence in the outcome, and it substantially diminishes the accuracy of the truth-finding process because the jury never hears evidence as to the ultimate question of why the confession was made by the petitioner. Why did he make those misstatements of fact? Why do those inaccuracies contained within the substance of his statement? Thus, the jury is unable to assess the effect of those circumstances on the confession's credibility and its weight, and surely that creates doubt and uncertainty as to the reliability and the accuracy of the jury's findings on this issue.
Mr. Hatt.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose just this one thing happened, that you asked the question, what size was the room that my client was questioned? And the judge, the other side, objects on the grounds that it's immaterial, and the judge sustains the objection. Without more, would you be here?
I think he'd have to make a specific objection saying that the size of the room relates to the issue of the confession's credibility.
And then the judge says, well, I still think it's immaterial. You'd still be here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Interrogation room?
This room here, Your Honor, is substantially larger than the interrogation room in which.
Hmm?
It's substantially larger than the interrogation room.
You mean
the
department?
No, I'm talking about where he was interrogated.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
How large is the usual interrogation room?
I'd say, well, the only ones that
you
I've.
You don't ever, know, do you?
The only ones I've seen are.
You don't know, do you?
No, sir, I can't give you a national
average.
Well,
I can object to the size.
Because the size of this room is small. It was 10 by 10 or 10 by 12 at best.
And well, you don't insist on a room this size, do you?
No, Your Honor. But I think that's a factor that the jury can use to determine the credibility. When the circumstances are viewed, the petitioner being a 16-year-old boy with operating at the level of a third or fourth grade child is put in this small room with several police officers, that bears on the reliability of what the defendant or the petitioner states to those police officers during the course of that interrogation. And that's why the size of the room is so significant. The Kentucky Supreme Court based its decision on several justifications, one of which included its perceived difficulty in separating evidence of the confession's voluntariness and evidence of its credibility. The Kentucky court reasoned that the separation function was better vested in the trial judge than in the hands of the jury. That conclusion, however, is based on a misperception of this court's rulings in both Jackson and Lego. This court acknowledged in those cases that there is, in fact, difficulty in separating evidence of a confession's voluntariness from evidence of its credibility. But neither case expressed any doubt that the jury was fully capable of properly using evidence for the purpose of determining confession's credibility and weight simply because evidence about the circumstances under which the confession was obtained is introduced. Neither did the court express any doubt that the jury could not properly discharge its fact-finding function merely because of the difficulty in separating evidence of the confession's voluntariness and evidence of its guilt. Indeed, the confidence that the jury can properly use evidence is, I think, a matter of common experience, and it's perhaps best reflected in the multiple admissibility rule, which, when applied to this case, would hold that evidence of a confession's credibility is not inadmissible simply because it is also evidence of the confession's voluntariness. As we indicated in the appendices to our brief, every jurisdiction, with the exception of Kentucky, that has ruled on this matter allows the jury to determine and hear evidence about the circumstances under which the confession was obtained for the purpose of determining either the confession's credibility, its voluntariness, or both. A second justification offered by the Kentucky Supreme Court for its rule was that the defendant offers very selective evidence when he doesn't testify in cases in which his confession is admitted as evidence against him. The court was concerned that the jury would not be made aware of the defendant's prior experience with the law, his familiarity with interrogating procedures, and his familiarity with his Miranda rights. Consequently, the Kentucky court reasoned that exclusion of such evidence would allow the defense to paint an unfair picture for the jury. That perceived danger, however, is unlikely to exist in any case, because if the defendant were able to raise improper inferences from the evidence or raise or submit improper evidence, the prosecution surely could object and refute that evidence by making specific objections, asking for admonitions, or even introducing rebuttal evidence. The justifications of the for which the Kentucky Supreme Court based its ruling herein do not justify the abridgment of the constitutional rights of the petitioner in this instance. Moreover, I think it's important to note that the state here was allowed to do precisely what the defendant was not allowed to do, and that is to introduce evidence about the circumstances under which the confession was procured. The state introduced evidence that on two occasions prior to giving the statement, the petitioner was fully advised of his Miranda rights. He was explained those rights in details and understood those rights. Moreover, the state was allowed to introduce evidence that during the course of the interrogation procedure, the petitioner was supplied with soft drinks and refreshments by the police officers. Now, obviously, the purpose in introducing such evidence is to demonstrate that the petitioner was well treated during the course of the confession, and thus the confession is credible, reliable, and trustworthy. Surely, if the prosecution can introduce evidence about the circumstances under which a confession is given to demonstrate its credibility, the same opportunity cannot be denied the defense, whereas here, his Sixth and 14th Amendment rights are at stake. The determination of the Kentucky Supreme Court and its ruling herein undermines the historical and the constitutional role of the jury to assess and determine the credibility and reliability of evidence in deciding the ultimate question of guilt and innocence. The findings here of the trial judge were deemed conclusive, and the jury could not consider any evidence about the circumstances surrounding procurement of the confession because he had already used that evidence in determining the confession's constitutional voluntariness. It's important here to realize that the confession's constitutional voluntariness is made without regard to its truth or its falsity, and therefore it's imperative that the jury be advised in full detail about all the evidence under which the circumstances of the confession was procured, because the judge doesn't decide the issue of credibility. The issue must therefore be decided by the jury. Since a voluntary confession can, of course, be untrue, it follows that as part of the right to present a defense, the defendant must be able to fully and effectively cross-examine and confront the police officers who participated in the course of the interrogation in order that the jury can assess the effect of the circumstances on the voluntariness of the confession. We would submit here that the Kentucky Supreme Court violated the petitioner's right to present a defense and his right to cross-examination, and that the rule created by Kentucky is not only artificial in the distinction it sought to draw, but is premised on a fundamental misunderstanding of the effect of the role of the trial judge plays in the suppression hearing. Consequently, the rule enacted by Kentucky results in an impermissible interference in the petitioner's right to present a defense, and we would urge the court to reverse this decision and remand the case for a new trial. Thank you.
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chief Justice Berger, and may it please the Court. Before proceeding with our analysis of the issue of this case, we'd like to correct, first of all, what is perhaps a mistake in the or a different emphasis in the facts, and that is that Major Crane was operating at somehow a diminished level or a diminished capacity. It was true, and it was stated that he was operating at a low academic level in the third or fourth grade, but he was evaluated as a sophisticated delinquent. And in its findings of fact and conclusions of law, the trial court stated that he had had numerous experiences with the law and was streetwise, knew very well what he was doing. And so we simply want to point that out to the court at the beginning.
These curious, almost fantasy responses.
Well, I think it bears on that because it is not the basis for these responses. I wouldn't be able to speculate why he said exactly what he said.
Well, if you're hypothetically, it may be that he had committed so many of these offenses that he got them confused in the record.
Absolutely,
but,
Your Honor.
Even assuming that's true, why aren't the circumstances admissible evidence under the Lego case?
Well, our contention is that the rule of the Kentucky Supreme Court in Crane is unexceptional in that it merely states that evidence to be admissible must be relevant. And then the Kentucky Supreme Court said that in this case, this evidence was simply irrelevant. Now, Lago said that the states have been as free since Jackson v. Deno as they were before to formulate their own rules of procedure so long as adequate safeguards are provided. And we believe that the Kentucky Supreme Court has done just that. It's not anything unusual or exceptional to say that evidence should be relevant. And the trial court merely made a ruling that the evidence was relevant, and that was upheld by the Kentucky Supreme Court. So we don't believe that Lago approves the procedure which was used by Kentucky in this case, but it doesn't really address the issue that's presented here, if indeed there is an issue presented.
Well, is your submission that any evidence that went into the voluntariness finding by the judge is wholly irrelevant to the reliability of the confession?
No, Your Honor, not at all. In fact, if I could read just briefly from the holding of the Kentucky Supreme Court, it said, once a hearing has been conducted pursuant to the rule and the trial court has made its ruling, and that ruling or finding that the confession was voluntary is conclusive, as this court permitted in Jackson versus Deno, the trial court may exclude evidence relating to voluntariness from consideration by the jury when that evidence has little or no relationship to any other issue. This shall not preclude the defendant from introduction of any competent evidence relating to authenticity, reliability, or credibility. So we're simply saying that all this rule does is say, reaffirm, really, the basic premise.
So then this case just boils down to, you would think there would be some evidence that if the trial judge excluded, it would be error. Some evidence that was introduced at the voluntariness hearing, you would think should be admissible.
I would say it could be argued that if that evidence had been used in the voluntariness hearing, then you could present the argument to the trial court that that issue had already been taken care of.
Can you think of any evidence that should be admissible with respect to reliability that was used at the voluntariness hearing?
Well, I think that would depend quite a bit on the case.
So you
really
can't even imagine any?
No, sir. I would say, as a matter of fact, we could say that assuming the petitioner in this case, if he were claustrophobic, perhaps, and you could lay a foundation, then that might be relevant.
So really, the Supreme Court's reservation really doesn't mean very much. What you're saying is, but they said that, but you can't imagine any evidence that the Constitution would require be admitted.
If the issue of voluntariness is a settled issue.
Well, it's settled. It's yes. Held to be voluntary.
Yes, sir. And in that case, there may be other cases in which the evidence which is presented at the suppression hearing is relevant to credibility, or there may not.
Well, why doesn't the evidence as to the size of the room here, which the defendant wanted to get at by cross-examination, why doesn't that bear on reliability in the sense used by the Supreme Court of Kentucky?
Well, I believe that
the fellow was in a fairly small room, you know, let's assume a hot sweat box, four or five officers there. You know, maybe he wasn't thinking too clearly.
Well, of course, now that brings up another point. His contention was that he made up a story to please the police. So I don't think if he were in a sweat box type situation that would necessarily relate to his propensity to make up a story to please the police, just as I might say, make up a story to please a teacher or some other authority figure.
I thought that often under interrogation felt a compulsion to say something, tell something, satisfy the police, get him off his back.
Well, if that's the case, if that's the basis for him saying that, then we would argue that it would be a case of coercion, and the confession would be involuntary in any event. But we're not saying that it is impossible for another court to disagree with the findings of the Kentucky Supreme Court that this evidence, in fact, was not relevant to this case. Another court may so find, but that still doesn't go back to the basic premise presented by the case, which is simply once the voluntariness issue is decided, that some evidence which is presented in the voluntariness hearing may then be properly excluded by the trial court at the regular trial. And if we could point out in the petitioner's petition for cert to this court, in some language that was dropped from his later brief, he said that in this case, the fact that a petitioner was given his Miranda warnings wouldn't have made any difference to this case. The Miranda warnings, the fact that he was given his Miranda warnings, might well and would indeed bear on the voluntariness of his confession. But it really isn't relevant, the petitioner stated before, to determining whether or not he made up a story to please the police. If the court disagrees with that finding of relevance, then that would be another factor to this case. But it doesn't go back to the basic premise that evidence to be admissible must be relevant, and that's all this court opinion says from the Kentucky Supreme Court.
Mr. Gillick, may I interrupt? I think one can read the Kentucky Supreme Court opinion is a little bit ambiguous. I have to agree. But having read the dissent, and the dissent seems to have read the majority as saying that voluntariness and credibility are sort of mutually exclusive categories, and that if it relates to voluntariness, and it's almost presumptively not relevant on credibility. It seemed to me one can read the Kentucky Supreme Court opinion that way, as saying there are two quite separate issues. And you're not defending that interpretation of the opinion, if I understand you. You're saying we should read the opinion differently.
Yes, I'm not defending the dissent's interpretation of this opinion. In the opinion, it says that the evidence in this case related solely to voluntariness, but it also said having little or no relationship to any other issue. And if evidence has little relationship to any other issue, it may have some relationship. So I think there is a bit of ambiguity there that would enable a finder of fact or a trial court to conclude that, yes, there can be evidence which is relevant to the voluntariness but is not relevant to credibility. And, of course, it works the opposite way as well. The trial court, in making that determination in the suppression hearing, is not permitted to examine the reliability of the confession in determining whether or not the confession is voluntary. So to that extent, the decisions of this court have indeed, I think, recognized a distinction.
Well, if we thought the dissent, however, was correct in interpreting the majority opinion below, I take it that you would agree we should reverse?
You're saying if we read...
If we read the majority opinion like the dissent did, you agree we should reverse?
No, if it would not be that if... You're saying if you would read the opinion to say that all circumstances relating to voluntariness are automatically excluded from a determination of credibility.
Isn't that what the dissent thought the majority said?
Apparently, I believe
suppose we agree that that's the way we read the opinion, too.
Well, I wouldn't believe that would be proper, but if you do read it that way, no, I wouldn't think it would be reversible error, because I believe that you could go ahead and if there is a distinction to be made, then it may be that the important factors which are to be weighed might justify making that distinction in all cases and saying, well, if it's raised in the voluntariness hearing and if it relates solely to voluntariness, then it can't be. Well, I'm getting very confused.
That's all right. That's all right. You can join the crowd.
The purpose of the suppression hearing is to determine the voluntariness, and the credibility is excluded. When you determine credibility, we would argue that simply that the court's opinion says some evidence may be excluded
right.
and some may
right.
not.
Right.
We affirm this on the basis of what the dissenting opinion said it means.
Well, I think it should be affirmed on the basis of what the majority said, not on the basis of what the dissent said. And
I know it's maybe I'm ignorant, but what is a vowel testimony?
Well, in that case, what they simply did was they took the police officers aside.
Well, what is a vowel testimony different from other testimony?
Well, they testified without the presence of the jury, so that we would have a record of what they would have said if they had been allowed to testify as they wish.
That means testimony outside of the jury.
Yes, Your Honor.
I assume that's peculiar to Kentucky.
May I ask this question? Was this 16-year-old given any opportunity to call his parents?
Yes, Your Honor. According to the testimony of the police officers, he was able to do practically anything he wanted to. If he had requested a call, then they certainly would have done that. He requested several things, to go to the restroom, and he requested a Coke and a bag of chips.
Was he specifically given the opportunity to call his parents?
I don't know if they specifically said, you may call your parents if you want. They made numerous efforts to contact his mother and his grandmother. I believe the record reflects 10 attempts in a period of about two hours.
Is that before or after the interrogation?
I believe this is a beginning before and continuing all the way through. He was only actually interrogated for about 45 minutes, as we document in our brief. He was, of course, in custody for a longer period of time. But the actual interrogation was very short.
What was the IQ of the defendant?
I don't believe that's reflected in the record.
There is some testimony, I think, to the effect that he was in the third or fourth grade or had ability of at that level.
Yes, Your Honor. He had been evaluated about 6 months prior to this by a social worker. He was in a program for juvenile delinquents, essentially, on another crime, and had been evaluated as operating at an academic third or fourth grade level. The trial court heard Major Crane testify at the suppression hearing, and at the conclusion of that time, the trial court simply said that this court recognizes that there are many people who have graduated from high school every day which are operating at the third or fourth grade level. The trial court and the social worker had evaluated him as a sophisticated delinquent who knew how to manipulate people to get what he wanted. And the trial court again found him to be streetwise.
Do high schools in Kentucky graduate people who are in the third and fourth grade?
Well, I think that happens in Kentucky. I think it happens everywhere. The fact that one has a high school diploma doesn't necessarily mean that one can read, unfortunately. But I don't believe – he certainly didn't have a high school diploma in this case. I don't believe that's in evidence. But we do believe that his prior experiences with the law are the kinds of factors which are relevant to a suppression hearing and which are brought out fully before the trier of fact, but which would never make it to the jury if the issue of voluntariness is then presented to the jury. So we think that that's an important factor. I would point out that in the Kentucky – Supreme Court's decision, they never attempted to define voluntariness and credibility, and perhaps some of the issues that the court seems to be concerned about are really what's going to happen in the next case when a confession comes down regarding another factor, whether the Kentucky Supreme Court would find that relevant or irrelevant. But the holding in this case, we believe, is very limited. It simply says that the evidence has to be relevant, and then it says that because the voluntariness hearing has been conclusively decided, that forecloses some items of evidence, and then it lists two of those items.
That's per se.
No, sir, I don't believe that.
If it's in the credibility, it's out at the trial.
No, sir, I don't believe so. I think what they're saying is that the trial court in each case, at the conclusion of a suppression hearing, assuming this situation would reoccur, would then evaluate what the defendant was seeking to present. I don't believe that it's enough for a defendant to stand up and say, okay, we argued voluntariness, we argued that we were held in a small, windowless room, and that was voluntariness. Now it's the trial, and we don't want to argue voluntariness anymore. We want to argue credibility.
I've listened to that, but I can't find it in the opinion anyplace.
Whether that
the opinion that before us is just opposite to what you said. It said if it's in the credibility, well, it's out.
No, sir. I believe it says that in this case, what it said was that because these issues had been presented to a voluntariness hearing, it's not really because it's presented to the voluntariness hearing. It's whether it relates to voluntariness. These issues might never have been even raised in the voluntariness hearing. But when the petitioner comes back and says, what we want to do is show that I was held in a small, windowless room, it doesn't matter whether that issue was faced in the suppression hearing. The trial court can say, but that's a voluntariness issue. You're arguing voluntariness, and that's already been decided. And so that evidence is simply irrelevant. We don't need to present it to the jury, and there are going to be significant disadvantages to the state if we do present it.
Well, take an old case from Mississippi where they took Yank Ellington, put a rope around his neck, and pulled him up over a rafter, and said they'd let him down as soon as he confessed, and assumed that was brought out in the admissibility hearing, and it was held to be admissible.
Yes, sir.
Would you be prevented from bringing that out? Would that be immaterial?
I believe that the situation there is not presented in this case, because that's a fact that's it's a disputed fact. In other words, whereas the facts which were sought to be admitted here were facts about which there was really no dispute.
On my Mississippi facts.
Oh, I see. But you're saying that the police officers didn't say that didn't happen. They accepted. They said
they
yes.
They bragged about it.
Well, in that case, then, of course, the confession would be involuntary and it would never be admitted.
Suppose it had been admitted as voluntary. And the defense counsel thought to bring out that the man was hung, would you think that was immaterial?
Your Honor, I believe that it probably would be immaterial. That's not what the Supreme Court has said, so I can't really say what the Kentucky Supreme Court would do.
Immaterial, because it was in the suppression hearing.
No, Your Honor, the Supreme Court, I don't believe the Supreme Court has made the ruling that strict. I don't believe
okay,
they said simply.
It doesn't apply to hanging.
But But I believe, on the other hand, that you would be talking about the necessity, perhaps, for having a second layer of defense, and that's not been constitutionally required by this court. We would have to rest, I believe, on this case, on the fact that the suppression hearing is there to make an initial determination of voluntariness. And assume
you've used the word. In fact, we all use the word voluntariness. Do you think voluntariness is kind of an either-or proposition, or do you think there are possibly degrees of voluntariness, and some confessions are a good deal more volunteer than others? And
well, certainly there are degrees of voluntariness.
And here what the finding in the suppression hearing is that it crosses at least a minimum threshold sufficient to make it admissible. But could it not be possible that it would still be relevant? The whole area of how voluntary it was would nevertheless be relevant on the question of credibility in almost every case?
Well,
I mean, if he walks in himself without any pre-warning or anything, he says, I want to confess to a crime I committed last Thursday at 8 o'clock, and that, you get one picture there where somebody sits in a small room with four police officers for an hour and a half and ends up by confessing, maybe that's not quite as voluntary as the first example.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even though it would be admissible.
And so I think that in each individual case, then, it would depend on what the defendant was arguing when he got to the trial and said, I want to argue credibility now. So that you wouldn't just say, just because the defendant lost the voluntariness hearing, therefore all circumstances of the confession are always admissible, which is exactly what petitioner wants. Petitioner wants that to say there is no distinction, therefore all the facts are admissible, and so we would disagree with that. It would be an evaluative thing by the trial court in the first instance.
What would be wrong with the rule that said, just open the gates and let everything in to tell the full story of the circumstances surrounding the confession, the extent to which it was voluntary, whatever, how tired he was and all that? What would be wrong with the rule that said all of that evidence would just come in and not worry about whether you call it voluntary or credibility? What would be wrong with such a rule?
Well, of course, that is essentially the Massachusetts rule. What we argue is wrong with the Massachusetts rule, two things. First of all, the trial judge who's making the initial voluntariness determination, if he knows that all that evidence is going to be presented to the jury again, then he has a reason to just sort of take a brief look at that confession and maybe not give the voluntariness hearing, the initial suppression hearing, the emphasis that it deserves as a binding, as a final, as a determination of that defendant's rights, whether they've been violated.
Well,
so he may
pass
it
to the extent that it governs admissibility before the jury. It's not final in any other sense.
Under the Massachusetts rule. But he may tend to just pass that along pro forma, and then you go back to what the result of this court disapproved of in Stein versus New York, which was also the case where the trial court would simply look at the confession, see if there was a reasonable issue, and then send it to the jury. And the problem this court found with that, and the problem that is still, we believe, in the Massachusetts rule, is that once the jury gets the confession, makes their decision, there's no real way to say, well, did they rely on the confession and convict him because of the confession, or did they not rely on the confession and convict him anyway? And that can cause problems later on for appellate review.
You're really arguing that the rule that you favor is better for the defendant. That's what you're really arguing.
Yes, sir, we believe so. We would simply say again that there are some sound policy reasons for this rule that have been enumerated by the Kentucky Supreme Court. Kentucky Supreme Court pointed out first that there was a difficulty in separating the factors relating to voluntariness and credibility, and felt that this determination, because there is some difficulty, is best left to the trial judge and not in the minds of the jurors. Kentucky Supreme Court pointed out that voluntariness is a settled issue, so that to the extent that evidence would relate to voluntariness, then it's not really necessary to retry that issue. And finally, if the evidence of voluntariness is retried to the jury, then there's the possibility of confusing the jury. There's the possibility that the defendant's previous experiences with the law would not get in. There's the possibility that his familiarity with Miranda rights and other things that would be relevant to the voluntariness hearing simply wouldn't be introduced. And the petitioner here has made the argument that if the prosecution could rebut, if the defendant got up and because he didn't take the stand created the impression that he was somehow misled by the police or coerced by the police, essentially, in arguing the voluntariness all over again. The problem is that under Kentucky, you would not be able to rebut. Even if the petitioner takes the stand under Kentucky law, the most you can do is ask if he's ever been convicted of a felony. And then when he says, yes, I have, then that's the end of it. You can't say, well, how many times have you been arrested? How many times have you been interrogated? And the defendant can't say, well, I've been interrogated 10 or 20 times just this year. It's simply not possible to effectively rebut a presumption, assuming such a presumption would be created. One final point that the petitioner has brought out, he says that Kentucky stands alone in this issue. I don't believe that if the court examines the cases which are presented in the appendix to his brief, that he will find, that you will find that Kentucky does stand alone. We're not saying that other states stand with us. We're not saying that we stand alone. The problem is that it's very difficult to sort out exactly where the states would come down on this issue because it hasn't really been presented. And many of the citations in his brief, for example, citations to rules, state rules of evidence, number 104, those are all patterned on the federal rule of evidence 104. And all that says is that no evidence relating to the weight or credibility of the confession shall be excluded. And that's exactly what Crane versus Commonwealth says. So simply because a state court cites to their own rule of evidence, which is patterned on federal rule of evidence 104, doesn't mean that they've looked at this issue or they've decided this issue. As we point out in our brief, we believe that the impetus for the Kentucky court's ruling or the Kentucky court's holding in Crane is simply that it's recognized the degree to which this court has adjusted what may come into a voluntariness confession and simply recognizes that they don't need to retry that issue before the jury. And so for these reasons, we believe that the rule of the Kentucky Supreme Court in Crane is a valid rule. It doesn't break any new ground, really, and for that reason, it should be affirmed. If there are no other questions.
Well, you have anything further, Mr. Heft?
If it pleases the Court, I've just got a couple of points to make on rebuttal. First of all, to answer just a couple of the factual questions that were raised during questioning by the Court, in regard to Justice Powell's question about the petitioner being able to call his parents, he did state on page 19 of the Joint Appendix that he requested to be called to call his parents, but he was not permitted to do so by the police. Of course, the police did testify in the suppression hearing that they made efforts to contact his family. I'd also like to point out that it seems to me that the questions relative to how the dissent in this case interpreted the majority's view of the rule is a point well taken, because here on page 29 of the respondent's brief, the respondent argues that if the trial court rules the confession voluntary and admits it into evidence, none, emphasis by the respondent, none of the circumstances surrounding procurement are relevant to its credibility. The dissent correctly analyzed the Kentucky Supreme Court rule here. Moreover, if, as we indicated in our brief, this is not the kind of situation, I believe, in which the court can approach the issue or resolve the issue by a bright-line approach, because evidence of credibility necessarily overlaps with evidence of voluntariness. What the respondent is arguing, in effect, is if we can somehow, is that the trial, that first of all, defense counsel is going to have to make some kind of a determination pre-trial. What is evidence of voluntariness? What is evidence of credibility? Secondly, the trial judge is going to, every trial judge in the country is going to have to make that determination. And then every appellate court in the country is going to have to review that decision. We think that would create an administrative and a judicial nightmare.
Assuming error, that it's harmless error?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe this is harmless. As I indicated earlier, I believe that the error here affected the outcome and raised doubts as to the reliability of the jury's verdict. Here the evidence is...
Well, because it raised doubts about the reliability of his confession.
Primarily because the confession was the principal piece of evidence in this case. We pointed out in our brief that the evidence of guilt was not overwhelming here because there was no physical evidence to link the petitioner to the crime. The inculpatory statement made by the co-defendant, we pointed out, was motivated in order to minimize his culpability here. The statement that the petitioner was alleged to have made to his mother is likewise subject to scrutiny and it seems to me to demonstrate a lack of credibility, because here we have a young man who has demonstrated a propensity to confess to crimes he's not committed. And we would urge, for those reasons, that this ruling, the error cannot be harmless. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday next at 10 o'clock.